Since the end of the Cold War, where have all the nukes gone? It's a question that came to mind with the recent announcement that a major Russian warhead removal program was shutting down after 20 years. The Megatons to Megawatts Atomic Recycling Program completed its final shipment of 500 tons of Russian uranium to the shores of the U.S. to produce power in U.S. nuclear reactors. At the close of the Cold War, thousands of nuclear weapons were scattered across the crumbling Soviet Union. 3,200 left in Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus. 22,000 additional tactical nuclear weapons somewhere within the confines of the former USSR. Slowly they were found, neutralized, and in many cases turned into nuclear fuel. The U.S. has eliminated thousands of nuclear weapons in that same time. While all of the former Soviet republics became nuclear-free by 1996, Russia was down to 2,700 warheads by 2011. The U.S. has actually built some new replacement weapons and has an arsenal that now stands at 5,113. That's at least according to the Pentagon in 2011. So the Megatons to Megawatts recycling program is all that more remarkable. Conceived by a civilian physicist, Thomas Neff, at the close of the Cold War, converted more than 20,000 Russian warheads into electricity for 1 in 10 American light bulbs over the course of 20 years. Joining us now is Dr. Thomas Neff, who currently works as a physicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
So what did you think the plans were going to be at the close of the Cold War for the nukes, and how did you come up with this particular way of disposing of Russian nuclear warheads?
Let me take you back to 1991. Bush and Gorbachev were trying desperately to try to get some sort of arms control agreements in place, and they agreed to certain reductions in deployed nuclear weapons. My question was, what would happen to the weapons? So I had a radical idea, essentially was proposed to the Russians that they blend down the high-enriched uranium in those nuclear weapons and sell it as power plant fuel to the U.S. Still in Cold War mode, the Defense Department didn't really want to aid the Russians in any way. And if the U.S. approached Russia, they would do what they usually do, which is demand reciprocity. That is, if we were to propose destroying 20 or 30,000 nuclear weapons, they would say, okay, let's have you destroy some. So that didn't go anywhere. I tried to convince the U.S. government to approach the Russians. It didn't work. So I approached them. So that started a long sequence of events, which culminated with the Russians essentially approaching the United States.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Americans needing to be convinced. What really turned the tide?
On the U.S. side, it was simply the interagency process had been considering my idea, but they couldn't reach any agreement. So when Viktor Mikhailov directly approached the United States in mid-1992, the U.S. had to get its act together. They had to answer the mail, in effect.
So technologically, what was the challenge in customizing this fuel to U.S. reactors?
Well, during that period in 91 and 92, the U.S. was freaking out about loose nukes. A lot of these nuclear weapons were stationed in Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan. So the Russians were desperate to get them back. And what I did was I essentially gave them a big financial incentive at the end of the whole process. The U.S. view was we should go in and try to help them keep track of their nuclear weapons. My view was if you put enough money at the end of the path, we can just run the whole machine backwards.
Well, how did you feel about the last delivery?
It was mostly a relief. I'd been pretty much under the radar for all those years. Had developed quite a good relationship with the Russians. They trusted me. It took a while, but essentially trusted me as a person they could talk to.
So the takeaway here kind of is the crazy, nudgy physicist ends up as the hero.
Well, I don't know about that. There are a lot of heroes in the world.
All right. Well, good luck with all that. And thanks so much for being a nudge.
Thanks. You too.
Dr. Thomas Neff is a physicist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the brains behind the Megatons to Megawatts program. So the idea of battlefield nuclear weapons, as distinct from strategic weapons, nukes personally delivered to the enemy like a sniper's bullet, was a bitter joke first portrayed in the movie Dr. Strangelove. Classic from that 50-year-old movie, actor Slim Pickens riding a warhead down to Earth to create a world-ending mushroom cloud. Decades after the Cold War, it is not the large nuclear bombs and missiles that scare us. It is the small ones that a whooping soldier could actually carry into battle.
The B-54 bomb is 18 inches long, 12 inches in diameter, and weighs approximately 58 pounds.
The B-54 Special Atomic Demolition Munition is one of the great ironies in history. This hard-to-track nukes acronym is SADM, Saddam, like the late Iraqi leader, the WMD devil himself. The Pentagon says SADM. It was a nuke as scary as it was convenient.
For parachutist delivery overland, the bomb, in the cloth bag, is installed in a parachutist container.
How convenient. Adam Ronsley writes about the B-54 SADMs in his latest issue of Foreign Policy magazine. Adam, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So how terrifying is it? And, you know, this is well-known stuff, a lot of it, although you've revealed some really interesting details. How terrifying is it to realize that Americans made a lot of the weapons that we were most scared of after 9/11?
Yeah, you know, it's pretty interesting. We accidentally made the perfect terrorist weapon.
Yeah. Thanks for that. What were the dimensions of it? Did you get a chance to actually put your hands on one? And who were the men who were responsible for delivering this?
No, we did not get a chance to put our hands on one. The government's a little bit skittish about that. They really wouldn't talk to us about it. In terms of the dimensions of program and who used it, you know, in terms of who used it, it's really into two different sections. Is in advance of an invasion, the job would fall to the ADM engineers of the Army, and their job was essentially to do nuclear scorched earth on friendly territory, to use these weapons to take out transportation infrastructure that could serve as an avenue of approach for the flood tide of Soviet armor that was pointed at us.
And this is the Warsaw Pact border in Europe huge numbers of Soviet troops that way outnumbered anything that the Allies could deliver, so the nukes were the great equalizer.
Exactly. And they would take out West German bridges, roads, tunnels, blow up dams in order to flood avenues of approach. You could use these things to sort of, use them on top of a hill or a mountain to fill up a valley pass. And the dicier side of it fell to Special Forces and Navy SEALs, who would have to parachute behind enemy lines to do, you know, similar things, but also to take out, you know, motor pools, tank pools, airfields, air defense networks. And that was, as you might imagine, a little bit of a hairy job, being the human guidance system for a nuclear weapon.
And one that, while as convenient as it is, still weighs well over 50 pounds and was pretty difficult to handle for a single soldier or even a team of soldiers.
Yeah, so they weighed about 60 pounds in the bare warhead unit. You add to that, if you're jumping out, you've got about 30 pounds of extra gear to keep it in its little protective case. And these things, you know, the Army did an ergonomic study and basically found out that, you know, surprise, they're not very comfortable. And, you know, the guys who use these things told us is that, you know, the weight would shift very uncomfortably, and it would shift unpredictably. And one of the guys we talked to, who was a Special Forces team leader, had to ski one of these things down the mountain. And he said, you know, it took the finest skiers they had just to stay on control in the slopes, because that thing shifts and you're out of control, and you're you are moving very fast down a mountain with a backpack nuke strapped to you.
I want to go back to something you said a moment ago that really stuck out in my mind. How well known was it among the Allies that this strategy involved detonating nukes in friendly territory, and certainly in nations that were, you know, far from the Russian border?
Well, it was very well known to the NATO allies exactly what we were planning to do. And it was, as you might imagine, it was an area of great concern. The thing is that in order to make it a little bit less destructive to the surrounding friendly countries, is that you could bury these weapons. But the problem is our NATO allies, particularly Germany, did not want to let us pre-dig the holes by their transportation infrastructure to dump these things in very quickly. And so there was a very, very big sort of public spat between the United States and its NATO allies, and lots of ink was spilled over competing studies about whether and how they should be used.
Are these things somewhere safely you know, put away, which actually
yes, they've been to sent to the old folks' home for retired nuclear weapons. They were pulled back to the continental United States in 1986, and they were retired in 1989. The last sort of trace I've seen of them is that their pits are rotting somewhere at the Pantex plant in Texas.
All right. Well, that's actually good to know. What was the response yes. when the Pentagon made these public, and you know, Americans learned in the mid-80s that these bombs had actually been produced?
Well, people were surprised, to say the least. It was William Arkin in 1984 who released a study based on congressional testimony. The field manuals for these, we actually found them on eBay. They were never classified. And he released this, and as you can imagine, there was in the early 80s lots of sort of contention over U.S. nuclear policy. And some in Congress were pretty angry about this, and it's fairly prescient is that some were saying is like I remember there's a great part in the Congressional Record from 84 where they're saying, well, can you imagine if you know Gaddafi or Iran got their hands on one of these things? So you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Well, we sort of dodged a bullet-shaped 58-pound nuclear warhead, quite literally. Adam Rumsley, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
Adam Rumsley writes about the B-54 SADMs in the latest issue of Foreign Policy magazine. Coming up on The Takeaway, the mayor of East Rutherford, New Jersey, where the Super Bowl is taking place. We know how he's spending his Sunday, but what about you? Are you kicking back on game day? A special Super Bowl tradition you'd like to share?
Hi, this is Alexa from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I usually skip the Super Bowl and watch the Puppy Bowl on Animal Planet. I've never really been that much into football except for maybe watching the halftime show.
Puppy Bowl, Alexa, certainly a favored alternative. For Murray, Kentucky, without a doubt, no Super Bowl is complete without a warm, real wood fire. Four sons curled up with me at game time is an experience never to be forgotten. That's a good one. Sounds cozier than MetLife Stadium. Tell us your Super Bowl traditions at 877-8MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.